Hi, I'm Brian Pearson. This is The Mystic Cave.
We were born before the wind. Also younger than the sun. And our modern boat was one as we sailed into the Mystic.
The Mystic Cave is a sanctuary for the seeker. Stories, conversations, and reflections about the spiritual journey on the other side of Churchland. I'm reading from my memoir, Lost Rites, Leaving Churchland. I'd rather skip this chapter. It's dark, and it's painful, and altogether too revealing. But I can't tell the story about leaving the church without telling this story about leaving my marriage. It'll become evident why. So, taking a deep breath, down we go to Chapter 12, Part 1.
Just like way back in the days of old. And together we will flow as we sail into the Mystic. Come on, come on.
One evening, as I made my way up from my basement study, Sandy was waiting for me at the top of the stairs. "What's going on?" she said. "You don't touch me? You don't talk to me? This is a marriage?" I nodded. I got it. "Okay," I said. "We should find a time to talk." I was putting her off, but I knew she was right. Our relationship had been disintegrating for years. Perhaps it had never been whole. Now we talked with one another only about domestic things. Who was driving the kids to school? How we were going to pay for our summer holidays. I took her out for a fancy dinner one night to celebrate the completion of her master's degree in nursing. We sat across from one another in the glow of the candlelight, sipping wine and trying to make conversation. I asked her what the degree meant to her and what her plans were going forward, as if I was conducting a pastoral interview. She told me later that that evening was among the worst of her life. For me, the household had become unstable and therefore unsafe. I never knew what new emotional bomb was going to go off or when. One day, Sandy was late coming home from work. I'd started making dinner. I asked quite sincerely as she entered the kitchen how her day had been. She shot back that it had been fine until she walked through the door. I had no idea what she was talking about, but I didn't ask. I put my head down and kept stirring. Even the little kindnesses were falling away. Ordinarily, Sandy would prepare lunch after church, and we would all sit down together as a family when I got home. One Sunday I came in, fatigued by the morning's demands and famished, to find that they'd gone ahead without me. The table had been cleared, the food put away, the dishes done, and I was left to fend for myself. A small thing, but telling. It was telling as well that I was spending more and more time down in my study. Our first year in Calgary, before my evenings began filling up with church work, I retreated to my study most nights to write. I had to get Father David across the country to the coast and then prod him through his spiritual crisis on his way to enlightenment. I needed to show that David was a man in deep trouble. His inner world was spilling out, forcing him to deal with things he didn't want to face. Having transplanted him to Euclulet, I gave him a crush on a woman he saw playing the cello under the stage lights of a community Christmas concert. I called her Daphne Hart and made her the local veterinarian. In his loneliness one night, David ends up drinking too much and writing her a maudlin letter, laying bare his feelings for her. Rather than leave it there as catharsis, too drunk to know the difference, he drives off and mails the letter. Later, sober and horrified by what he's done, he goes to visit Daphne at her clinic, anxious to set things right. I made it a particularly cringeworthy part of David's story. It was pivotal. It showed how far he had sunk into his own emotional quagmire. He was hitting the bottom, from which up was the only way out. It was as if I knew. But I had an inside track, didn't I? Because it was almost all true, not metaphorically, but literally. I was projecting my own troubles onto David, a fictional character, as if that's all I had to do to solve my problems. But like Father David, I just couldn't leave it there. When Passion Tide was published, I needed to seal off some of the memories awakened by my writing to dispel the discomfort they caused within me. So I looked up the address of the real person for whom Daphne Hart was the stand-in, the teacher from Euclulet, and I sent her a copy of the book along with a note. She was not Daphne, I explained, but certain scenes would be familiar to her, perhaps awkwardly so. The book was my peace offering. I said a few things about what had been going on in my life at the time, as if it was all in the past, as if I had moved on and was living now in the light of a new day. I apologized again. I wished her well, with the hope that you are not too harsh on a silly middle-aged man who, every so often, has this need to do something really dumb just to prove to himself that he's still human. Well, human, maybe. That was a nice touch. But not as lovable as he thought he was. Because once the book was done, and I was back to being out at work 2 or 3 nights a week, I continued to retreat to my study. Coming home late in the evening, instead of going to bed, I would be drawn downstairs to the pulsating glow of the computer screen, anesthetized by a glass of scotch, playing computer games, and trolling for porn. I was hiding. I knew it. I was wilting on the vine. I knew that too. And the internet was the worst possible outlet for someone feeling lost and lonely. Interconnectivity might have been its claim, but disconnection was its actual game. Its vacuous pull was addictive, and I didn't know how to surface. To come up from the depths would mean confronting the awful truth. Our marriage was dead, and there was nothing to do but call it. For months, I resisted facing reality. I had, after all, been married before. I didn't feel I could afford to be seen to fail again, not in the eyes of the church, not in the eyes of my children, and not even in my own eyes. From my first divorce, I'd used a get-out-of-jail-free card. I was young and foolish and not yet ordained, so there was room for forgiveness all round. But a second failure, now, with growing children and a mortgage and a big parish to run? It was unthinkable. Sandy and I would sometimes circle the issues, testing the waters for a real conversation, but it would always go badly. I'd get all vague and abstruse, managing the conversation so things wouldn't get out of hand, and so I wouldn't actually have to name the uncomfortable truths. Sandy would go straight to blame, either assuming it herself, as if that's what I wanted to hear, or deflecting it onto me. I almost always walked away feeling we had just made things worse. In the spring of 2004, Sandy and I took a road trip back to Vancouver Island, a mini-holiday, to see if we couldn't get things back on track. The whole way out, I couldn't speak. All my unexpressed thoughts and suppressed feelings were bubbling up to the surface. I feared they would spew out and wreck everything. We couldn't agree between us where to stop overnight, so we just kept driving, all the way to Horseshoe Bay, where we ate bad Chinese food late at night and fell into bed, exhausted, in the only motel room we could find. The next morning, on the ferry, I summoned the strength to speak the unspeakable. Things were not going all that well between us, I said. I intended it as a neutral observation, an invitation that might stimulate the conversation we needed to have. But Sandy was ready for something else. Great, she said. I knew this would happen. I knew you'd bring me all the way out here to tell me you're leaving me. That's not what I had in mind. But now it was impossible for me to think anything else, as if talking about our marriage had just been taken off the table. It was a long few days. When we returned to Calgary, I made contact with a therapist. Marv Westwood was a teaching psychologist in the Faculty of Education at the University of British Columbia. He had done some consulting work with our diocese, which was how I knew him. He said I should come out for a few days. It was early summer, and the school term had ended, so I booked a room on campus and, at his suggestion, arranged to see him on two successive days, a couple of hours each day. On the first day, he wanted to know my life story, especially the significant branching points that had determined its direction, the moves, the family dynamics, the faith journey. He listened as I talked. Then, when I had laid it all out, he leaned in. "And what does Brian want?" he asked. It was like an arrow to the heart. No one had ever asked me that. I felt the familiar lump rising in my throat. This is what came out. I wanted my life back. I wanted my children in my life. And then something I hadn't intended to say, something I'd never consciously thought. "Before I died," I said, "I wanted to fall in love." Twice I had married, but neither time because I was truly, stupidly, gobsmacked crazy in love. I married Joan because Dave Ward made it sound like a moral imperative. I married Sandy because she felt safe. Now, at 50, I was still looking for the experience that had eluded me all my life, falling in love. Though the moment the words came out my mouth, I knew in truth I was already in free fall. Jean was a member of my congregation. We sat on the same committees. When somebody said something outrageous, for which there might have been a sarcastic reply, we looked across the table at one another. When she sold her culinary expertise at a fundraising talent auction, half a dozen of us bought the right to be her dinner guests. I helped her out in the kitchen while the others, including Sandy, sat talking around the dining room table. Jean and I cleared plates and refilled glasses as if we'd been doing it together all our lives. It was, of course, illicit love. I was married, she was not. And a priest and a parishioner, it is argued, do not approach one another from the same power base, the priest, presumably, being the one with the power. It didn't feel like that to me. In any case, it was all in my imagination. Jean, who didn't know of my feelings, didn't represent an actual threat to my marriage. Instead, she excited within me the possibility that I might still love someone and be loved in return before I died. Who knew? If there was a God, a compassionate, forgiving God, it might even be her. Marv could see the tectonic plates shifting within me as I left his office. He was concerned enough to call me at home a few days later after I'd returned. He wanted to track me, he said. My time with him had created inner movement, which may have been the thing I needed most, but it was the very last thing I wanted. I was terrified. I felt I had been unmoored and was drifting into the dark of night, where the tide was carrying me out to sea. A few months later, Marv showed up in the diocese as one of the leaders of our clergy conference. It was held that year not in the spring, as usual, but in September. Marv was leading us through a consideration of life stages and their effect upon our ministries. I could barely allow myself to follow along. It made me dizzy. It was too close to home. The evangelical clergy sat together in their table groups at the far end of the room, some with their arms folded across their chests, looking through a glass, darkly. The speakers didn't quote enough scripture. They didn't open in prayer, and they didn't talk about their relationship with Jesus, so their insights were not worthy of those who considered themselves holier than they. When we moved into small breakout groups and needed to choose someone to report back to the larger assembly, a colleague suggested that the reporter shouldn't be me. There were those present, he said, who wouldn't listen to a thing I said. His words stung, but I knew he was right. In truth, though, I wasn't even thinking of opening myself up to that brood of vipers. I couldn't. I was too distracted, preoccupied with my personal life, obsessed even. I sought a personal conversation with Marv. We met in his room. He listened as I tried to explain what was happening, but speech was difficult, and in any case, superfluous. We both knew this wasn't something to be solved by words. It was more like a stone, forcing its way up from my gut, choking me, restricting my ability to breathe. Marv encouraged me to accept what was happening without judgment, to trust whatever it was that was working itself out within me. But I couldn't focus. My brain kept shorting out. I gulped at the air in short gasps. A reckoning was on its way. There was no stopping it, and I wanted nothing more than to push it all back inside and make it go away. Rim Cottage was a simple A-frame cabin on rugged oceanfront property that spilled right out onto the beach itself. It had been the generous offer of a couple who were members of my Tofino congregation. They lived in Vancouver, but owned the cottage on Chesterman's Beach, where they spent weekends and holidays. They offered me the use of it if ever I needed to return for some R&R. Late in October 2004, I took them up on it. I moved into the cottage, alone, for a 10-day retreat. The front windows looked out onto the weathered spruce and the ground cover that separated the cottage from the beach, but a loft above the main room, accessible by a steep ladder, offered more. It was a small room and cozy, with a bed and a desk, and with a commanding view of the entire bay. Beyond was the open ocean, all the way to the horizon. When I wasn't walking the beach or preparing a meal, I spent my time up in that safe space, the sloped wooden ceiling bending low over my head like a fort in the trees. That was where I slept at night and sat to write during the days, or stared out across the ocean until the light grew dim. And that was where I began to admit the painful personal questions whose answers were long overdue. Back in Calgary, before I left, separately, I'd taken Heather out for lunch and the boys out for breakfast. I needed to prepare them for what was coming. "Your mom and I have been having some problems," I told them. "So I'm going away for a few weeks to try and sort things out in my own mind. But to be honest, it doesn't look that good." Sandy had tried to stop me from doing this, but I couldn't lie to them about why I was going away. I reassured the three of them that whatever happened when I returned, they were loved and we would all be okay. But none of us ate the meals that were placed in front of us. Now, the waves curled in on themselves and the mist rolled in from the ocean. The bracing breeze smelled of rotting seaweed, but also of fresh cedar. A colony of lolling seals drifted by a short distance from shore, locked together into a floating island, a flipper raised here or there like a sail. Eagles glided silently in and out of the low cloud cover overhead, watching. Finally, I was able to let it all go. I inhaled deeply, replacing the stale city air in my lungs with the salt spray of the ocean. I allowed myself to imagine a new future, without concern for what must happen between now and then. After a week, I started writing. Not the novel I had told some people I was going away to start, but a letter, to to Sandy. I was leaving the marriage. On my way back, I went to see Marv in Vancouver. I shared with him my plans. I read him the letter. He said it was lovely, a celebration of all that was good about my years with Sandy. He hoped she would receive it that way. I talked with him about Jean and the unwitting role she had played in this unfolding drama. He leaned back in his chair, and he smiled at me. "There's something sort of noble about you, isn't there?" he said. "Most guys would just go and have the affair, but not you." I wondered what he meant. Was he laughing at me or admiring me? But I clung to his words in the months to come, when wagging tongues began hurling accusations of infidelity in my face. I didn't feel very noble, though, as I drove back to Calgary, my letter in hand. I got home and said only that we needed to talk when we had the chance. It was Sandy's birthday, so in the meantime we rallied to act like a normal family. The next day was Sunday, and also Halloween. I was scheduled to preach out of town in the morning in Elnora, a pulpit exchange I had agreed to months ago. Sandy was going with me. On the way up, I needed to work on my sermon in my head and get in the zone for delivering it. But afterward, as we began our drive home, I handed Sandy the letter. I asked her to read it. 10 days had given me a lot of time to reflect on what I wanted to say. This included my fear that if I tried to speak it, I would lose my nerve. So the letter contained as closely as possible what I wanted Sandy to hear. As Marv said, there was a lot there to celebrate the good that had come from our 21 years of marriage, not least of which were our 3 children. Sandy read it through, got to the end, and folded it up. "So," she said, "you don't love me." That was all she'd heard. Perhaps that was all she was capable of hearing, and perhaps I shouldn't have expected more. We drove the rest of the way home in gut-twisting silence. We dropped by her parents' house to pick up a birthday cake her mother had made for her, but we declined to stay for a visit. They could sense something was wrong. When we got home, there was much buzz about the door as trick-or-treaters came and went. When the flow finally slowed to a trickle, Sandy and I talked some more. "I could move out after Christmas," I offered, "find an apartment." But something was not resonating as it might have. We had had conversations like this before, but oblique and cryptic, more like we were discussing an idea, not a plan. Once, Sandy had even talked about going off to Victoria by herself to begin a doctoral degree. That sounded like separation to me, without our naming it. But now that I was the one talking about it, concretely, it was no longer just an idea, and it no longer felt mutual. Sandy went off to work in the morning. I poured myself another coffee and began to prepare for my return to the office the next day. St. Stephen's had hired a new staff member, Lynn McEwen, as our parish administrator. I was looking forward to working with her and needed to have something ready for her by way of orientation. In the afternoon, I slept. There had not been a lot of sleep the night before. That evening, we ate dinner with the kids. Heather went off to work at her part-time job, and I went down to my basement study. Suddenly, Sandy was standing in the doorway. "If you're leaving," she said, "I think you need to go now." Many times I had participated in, and sometimes even led, that group exercise where you're asked, "If your house was on fire, what would you take with you?" I had often answered, "My guitar," or photo albums, things with sentimental value. But here, now, was that moment. I had no idea what to take. I fumbled around for an overnight bag and began stuffing things into it. I chose a few files and books and closed up my briefcase. I never even thought about my guitar. I emerged from the basement. Sandy had gathered Robbie and Ben in the family room. They stood close to her side, not knowing where to look. But there was panic in their eyes. I hugged the boys. I told them I loved them. I reassured them everything would be okay. Then I drove off into the night. A few blocks away, I had to pull over. Sobs burst from my chest. Tears poured down my face, blurring my vision, running like salty rivers into the corners of my mouth. I gasped for air, and as I did, I moaned. I could see Robbie and Ben, the look on their faces searing itself into my memory. I grieved, not for my marriage, but for what this would do to my children. "I'm sorry," I whispered into the dark. "I'm so sorry."
And when that foghorn blows, I will be coming home.
I've been reading from Lost Rites, Leaving Churchland. If you're still with me, thank you. The spiritual journey is defined more by the dark places than the light. If it were all light, there would be no journey at all, just a beatific vision in which to bask, a place we call heaven. If my dark path casts light on your own, feel free to share something of your story. You can leave a post on the Facebook group, The Mystic Cave, or you can write me personally at mysticcaveman53@gmail.com. I'm relieved to tell you that my story does not end here. New life will rush in where the old used to be. But first, the church would have to have its say, and that would change everything. I'm Brian Pearson. This has been The Mystic Cave.
But it's too late.